Due to the global outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic, Voice of America is taking every necessary precaution to safeguard its employees, so our broadcast will look a little different today. And in the near future, as we, out of an abundance of caution, reduce our staffing at VOA headquarters here in Washington, we are working to help keep you informed. And we appreciate your staying with us on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, you're welcome to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. And the discussion for today is about African efforts to fight the coronavirus pandemic with scientific and technological tools. Across Africa, people are finding local solutions to the global challenge of the coronavirus pandemic. From technological innovation to community collaboration, ordinary citizens are using the resources at hand to address the unprecedented hurdles they are facing. My colleague Zoe Laudaki has more.
In Senegal, 3D printers are being used to compensate for a lack of medical equipment in health centers. A local technology group is mobilizing 3D printers in small workshops throughout the country to make plastic visors for healthcare workers. In Dakar, workshops print and assemble dozens of masks every day before delivering them free of charge to hospitals, pharmacies, and clinics.
We saw that there were a lot of initiatives in other countries to equip doctors. In Senegal, we have a problem regarding equipment and resources. We had a 3D printer, so we started manufacturing because we could help.
Similarly, in Liberia's capital, Monrovia, residents are taking matters into their own hands by setting up neighborhood checkpoints to screen the temperature of those who enter and wash their hands, a strategy already used during the Ebola outbreak a few years ago.
Liberians are still doubting that the sickness is not in the country. That's all their belief. So when they saw the guys putting those gates and things down, telling people to wash their hands, having the instrument testing and taking the temperatures and things, some start to get the idea that indeed it is true.
In South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa has announced a landmark $26 billion relief package to boost the economy and support the country's most vulnerable people. This comes after violent clashes with police in some areas over food parcels amid one of the world's strictest COVID-19 lockdowns.
Another significant area that requires massive additional expenditure is the relief of hunger and social distress in our communities across the country.
However, some local measures elsewhere have raised eyebrows. Madagascan President Andry Rajoelina is promoting a drink that he says can prevent COVID-19 and cure infected patients. Based on local medicinal plants, the concoction is prepared with artemisia, a plant with proven success to treat malaria. It must be stressed, however, no published scientific study has shown that the COVID organics herbal tea is effective in treating the coronavirus. Even so, the military is now distributing the drink to residents and students who are returning to school after a month of confinement. Alternative medicine is nothing new in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where Kinshasa traditional healers say these Congo Bololo leaves alleviate coughs and fevers when boiled. Meanwhile, health workers and doctors in Malawi are refusing to work until the government provides them with personal protective equipment and better pay in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. At the Kamuzu Central Hospital in Lilongwe, many patients were forced to return home as there was nobody to attend to them. In Uganda, Kampala authorities are providing shelter to street children during the nationwide lockdown. 180 of the most vulnerable are being housed in a primary school.
When the lockdown happened, We had children that live and work on the street, and when the directive to stay at home was made, they did not have a home to go to because their home is on the street.
Local music has got a continental twist as well. The United Nations Children's Fund has released a new version of the Miriam Makeba hit Pata Pata, performed by Benin's Angelique Kidjo. The tune remains the same in what was once called the world's most defiantly joyful song. This is what we gotta do, Papa. The song has particular resonance for Kidjo, whose friend, Afro-jazz icon Manu Dibango, died earlier this month from the coronavirus. Zoe Liudaki, VOA News.
Joining me via Skype are two distinguished guests. My colleague Anita Powell, VOA Southern Africa correspondent, she joins me from Johannesburg, South Africa. And
Professor Fred Makbaganorili,
an engineer and inventor at the Academic City University College in the Ghanaian capital, of Accra. Well, Anita and Fred, I have to say that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
You're most welcome, Anita. The last time I saw you standing was in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare, nearly 2 years ago when we were covering the election.
Back when we could still get on airplanes and travel. Those were the days.
You're most welcome. And as for Professor Makbaganorili, I have to say that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa for the first time.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here. I've heard your name for so long. It's happy to see you in person. You look a whole lot more handsome.
You're most welcome, sir. Yeah, let me begin with the business at hand. Talk to me, Anita. What is the mood on the ground from your vantage point in Johannesburg?
Well, it's quite varied, and I think it's important to say that, like, I think the majority of South Africans, my family and I are strictly observing the lockdown order, which is one of the strictest lockdowns in the world. You're not allowed to walk your dogs, you're not allowed to leave your property. So anything I'm about to tell you is kind of through that lens, because I'm not, as I usually am able to go out and just speak to South Africans from different backgrounds and get their feelings. So what I have gleaned from talking to many South Africans remotely is that there's a great amount of support and respect for President Cyril Ramaphosa's strict lockdown measures. However, there's also a lot of frustration in a country with such high unemployment and such high inequality, that this lockdown is really laying bare a lot of the injustices and inequalities. Families are really struggling to get food. Families are really struggling to get income, to provide for their basic needs, to pay their rent, and so on and so forth. And this is a very real problem that, the president really has to balance this in addressing how to tackle the coronavirus, because we all know this lockdown cannot continue forever without breaking the backs of millions of South Africans in other ways. So it's a very mixed bag, but I think overall South Africans are really proud of their leadership right now. And I think that's a sentiment that's being expressed pretty much across the board.
Very interesting. Professor Fred, what about you? Mm-hmm. What exactly is happening or not happening from your vantage point in Accra?
Well, so we were locked down for a while, and on Monday, we were relieved. There was a lot of jubilation on the streets. We are still struggling, you know, culturally with this whole issue of social distancing. We're quite a tactile people, so naturally people aggregate first, and then social distancing becomes a second thought, like, oops, can we back off a little bit? There's a sense of normalcy since the lockdown was lifted up on Monday. People seem to be going about their business as usual. I've seen many more face masks. But there were similar feelings, as Anita had expressed. People, families were really struggling. Most people that live by the day could not get by the day jobs anymore. And so I think part of the lifting of the lockdown was also in response to the level of frustration that people were beginning to experience and the fact that the handouts were not getting to everybody. And in some places, when the trucks actually arrived with food, there was so much chaos just in the sheer number of people that were waiting to be fed, that the whole idea of isolation really started not to mean much. So we feel a certain sense of normalcy, although in the last 4 days, the numbers seems to be going up rather than down.
You know, there's a debate here. There's a debate back here about the business of social distancing and trying to gradually also open up, because in this country, as you probably know, we are also experiencing lockdown. How do people balance the badly needed social distancing and the opening up so that people can go about their business?
Well, I mean, if I can take that, I mean, what has become obvious with coronavirus in general is that it seems to be a new type of virus, and Africans have been living with the virus of starvation for a very, very long time. So there is also a certain sense of detached sensitivity to what corona really is, when people actually live with the scourge of hunger every single day. So what I am observing on the streets right now is that people don't really care much. Those that do care are people in the middle class like me and others who are professionals and kind of understand the ramifications that the coronavirus presents. But for the average Ghanaian, I don't think they take this any more seriously than they take the natural strive for survival.
If I may add to that, Shaka, I just want to say that in South Africa, we're seeing an especially interesting and worrying dynamic, because our first coronavirus case was a South African who traveled to Italy, which many South Africans read as South African society tends to do, through a lens of race. And so far, the hotspots in South Africa are in my neighborhood, in the wealthier neighborhood, the richest square mile in Africa of Sandton, and so on and so forth. That is where it began, because it was brought from mobile people who had the income to travel internationally. And so I feel like a lot of South Africans do feel, as Dr. Fred said, that this doesn't really touch them because it's not something that does affect them. We know otherwise scientifically. We know that the coronavirus doesn't care how much money you have, where you're from, how much education you have. It's going to do the same thing to you. But it is interesting how it's exposing some fault lines in South African society. And it's worrying, because the Rainbow Nation should be all together at a time like this. And these fissures are not really helpful. And so one hopes that, you know, we can get through this.
You're quite correct, Anita. The coronavirus pandemic seems to be a sort of an equal opportunity employer.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. Every week, connect with our experts. You can ask them your questions and get their advice. Join me, Lino Mudu, in Washington on Healthy Living, your new health program, right here on Voice of America.
when the government of Nana Akufo-Addo decided to unlock the lockup, was it, for example, guided by science and facts, or was it guided by politics and emotions?
Saka, you're trying to get me into trouble. You know, I think the first natural reaction when the crisis first broke was to hunker down. I think there was a general euphoria across the country that something needed to be done by the political establishment. So the first natural step was to say, we are in charge, we're taking over this, we're going to lock down the country a little bit and see what happens. But since the country was locked down, the numbers have actually been going up. They're not going in the opposite direction. So the question that naturally begs is, at what point are we going to say the country is open? So that's one. The second thing was that as food distribution started off in certain specific area, the very things that we sought to avoid with the shutdown was obviously out of control. People were coming out in the streets at night. People were desperate. I think it also became obvious that, you know, as somebody said, families are for once in many, many years seeing each other at home. People were starting to get bored. People were starting to get fed up. People were starting to get hungry. And so, you know, the science shows that the numbers are going up. So it's obviously not, it has to be an issue of social or political.
I see.
Because the numbers, the last 4 days, the numbers have gone all the way up to about 1,100.
Hello, Fred, are you okay?
Yes, I'm good.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, by the way, that according to some reports that we are getting, it looks like the opening up in Uganda does not really look good, because we are in fact told that the numbers of infected people have actually been climbing up.
Yes. Yes. You know, Shaka, I understand. But from where I sit as a president, but when I also look forward, I ask the question, at what is it okay to open up? No, nobody seems to have the answer. And so it has to get untold. Part of the story being that people are going to die. People are going to die. That's obviously what it is. But there is no formula as to what else we can do, because we can't shut down forever. But what is the minimum threshold for opening up the country? It seems to be a political will or some sort of frustration from the people is what is actually driving it. But at a certain point, we just have to put a stake in the ground and say, let's put into practice social distancing. Let's put into practice washing hands before accessing public. Let people wear masks. This cannot be mitigated. This pandemic cannot be mitigated with people simply hunkering down.
I see. Anita, you come from a country by African standards, or as a matter of fact, globally, a country that is endowed with plenty of wealth. It is also a country that one could say fits in what one would characterize as, to whom much is given, more is expected. Here, I am reminded of December 3rd, 1967, Anita, when I was young, growing up in Kabale, southwestern Uganda. A one Dr. Christian Bernard was reported to have carried out the first ever successful heart transplant in a hospital in Cape Town. This is a man who had studied medicine at the University of Cape Town and also in the United States at the University of Minnesota, which happens to be part of an exclusive club of medicine, the Mayo Clinic. Are there any interesting innovations that you can walk us through that have probably happened or surfaced since the assault of the coronavirus pandemic on South African soil.
Absolutely. But before I address that, I just want to talk about going back in history and looking at Dr. Christian Barnard's remarkable achievement. It was a different South Africa. And I think we need to decolonize our thinking on the magnitude of that achievement and who may have underpinned that achievement and how much of that achievement, as impressive as it is, as enduring, as important as it is, was also underpinned by white male privilege. So I just want us to recognize that that was a remarkable medical achievement, but it was a very different country that was basically governed by a policy of racism that we need to acknowledge. And it does, I think, somewhat diminish a little bit from the magnitude of that when you look at it in that context. I just think we need to look at it in that context. Let's talk about innovations, because South Africa is nothing if not innovative. This is a country of doers. Our national motto may as well be, let's make a plan. South Africans have just come out of the woodwork to make plans to deal with coronavirus. And three of the most impressive that I want to talk about today. One is two scientists in Cape Town have developed a 65-minute coronavirus test. This is a remarkable achievement, but I do need to slow down the excitement on that by noting that it's still in the testing phases and will not be rolled out before June. So it's a 65-minute coronavirus test, which is considerably faster than the current 3-hour test that's available, but it's not going to be available until about June, but it's still a remarkable achievement. Another one that crossed my desk the other day was that students at the University of the Witwatersrand are laser cutting face masks and creating PPE for local health workers, which is really great and remarkable. And I think they've created thousands of face masks for local health workers. So that's really great. And a third innovation that I want to talk to that kind of feeds into the bigger public health situation in South Africa is an innovation I did a story about a few days ago. It's called the e-pharmacy. And what it basically is it's an ATM style pharmacy where you go and you have a 3-minute consultation with your pharmacist and then collect your chronic medication. This is not for coronavirus patients. This is for patients with chronic conditions. And I must remind you that South Africa has the world's highest burden of HIV. This is largely for those patients who are compliant and who really do not want to go and stand for hours in a queue at a government clinic right now to pick up their ARVs for many reasons. It's not safe. They're already compromised immunologically. So now they can go to these pharmacies around South Africa and pick up their medication without making any human contact. And what that is doing effectively, it's taking the burden off the public health system because it's taking them out and kind of putting them to the side and say, okay, you're fine. We're not going to worry about you. Don't add to our burden. And so that's a really interesting innovation that I think will grow in South Africa and maybe even globally.
It's very interesting, Anita, that you pretty much talked about the accomplishments of Dr. Christian Barnard and provided the context, because no one tells us, for example, given the fact that you are talking about apartheid South Africa during those days, which was like Jim Crow conditions here in the United States, no one in fact talks about how the Africans in fact were free guinea pigs. We do not know, for example, how many African patients he had to go through before he finally succeeded in that operation, which, by the way, was carried out on another white patient who became the recipient of that heart and a new lease on life.
I think it's actually a little bit more than that. I'm thinking more of other important scientific discoveries, like, for example, Watson and Crick's 1953 discovery of the double helix, which we now know was largely the work of their lab assistant. I believe her name was Rosalind Franklin. We're looking at Dr. Marion Sims, the American gynecologist, who conducted countless experiments on Black women patients without any regard for their pain or, you know, their experience, their input. Is it possible that when Christian Barnard did that, that there was an equally qualified, brilliant surgeon who might have been black and female, who could have done the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
But that society have allowed her to. And so I just think we need to look at it in that context. I mean, as I said, I'm not taking away from this massive achievement that's improved humanity, but I do think we need to take it in that context.
You remind me, of course, of the Tuskegee experiment on African Americans, who were used as guinea pigs in the process of trying to figure out the causes behind the disease known as syphilis during the Jim Crow War, the Jim Crow period era in the United States. Thank you. Now, Fred, let me come to you, Fred. Talking about people who are very enterprising and people that have risen to the occasion. I was reading somewhere that you have actually done something that was initially believed perhaps to be impossible to make, because at one time, in fact, there was a problem of whether or not one could have enough ventilators in the United States right here, a country that historically has been on the cutting edge of technology. Is it true that you have actually been in a position of building a prototype or a couple of prototypes of ventilators?
Yes. So let me head back to a little bit of the stuff that Anita said and put this in context. So, you know, South Africa has been fortunate enough to have been the home that has grown a lot of local innovators and inventors. Unfortunately for us, we have to go abroad to shine. Some of the most accomplished engineers, whether in fiber optics or in signal processing, have been Ghanaians resident elsewhere. This is a nation of innovators. It's a nation of doers. But the ecosystem has not been particularly supportive. It has been friendly, but not particularly supportive. And so, you know, I lived and worked in the US, spent over 25 years there, went to college there, and spent 16 years working in medical devices. And so when this pandemic started, we were told on a Saturday that on Monday, the whole nation was going to shut down. And I was thinking, how long can we hunker down? At a certain point, we have to stand up and fight. Pandemics are not things you hide away from and pray. They are things that will force you into innovation because you need to solve them. So I basically sent out a call on Facebook. I said, are there any people out there who would like to join with me to build a ventilator? Because we only have 67 in this country. And I had over 100 responses from across the world, including South Africa, Ghanaians in the diaspora. And ultimately, I brought 10 people together, and in less than a week, we had assembled four serious candidates for full version ventilators that can ultimately help augment the 67 that we have. And we build that mostly from local materials and parts that we harvested from vehicles. So a short answer to your question is that, yes, we have developed four ventilator prototype candidates that can be commercialized to support the COVID-19 efforts.
How much did each of those prototypes cost? And where did you get the funding from, at least the initial funding?
Yes. So we have spent about $4,000 right now on all the four that we came up with. The plan is to make them for about $300 to about $1,000 per one. Most of the funding came from me, of course, and then from the goodwill of people who were enthusiastic to support students. Right now we're and most of my team members were second-year engineering students from my college. And so we're getting $20 here, $10 there, $50 there from well-wishers who were basically cheering us on. And we're so excited that, you know, folks in the country will stand up to face this challenge head on rather than hunkering down in the bunkers hoping and praying that this will go away naturally.
I feel like this pandemic has really unearthed some serious African excellence.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about the African excellence that we have seen? Especially, I almost feel like we're seeing a reversal, hopefully, of the North-South.
Go ahead. Yeah, I'd like to say something about that. Yes. I think one of the things that triggered myself and the team into action was when we started reading in the news that the U.S. was refusing medical supplies to Canada. The Turks were refusing medical supplies to the Spanish. And so in times of adversity like this, nations tend to be inward looking. And so what is so exciting about this period for Africa is that we have always found the excuse of expediency by going abroad to buy stuff to solve problems that we consider emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And now we may have the money, but we can't find these things to buy. So even the policymakers and the decision makers are waking up to a new era of a unique realization that it is time to do something. And that this disease, which is an equal employer killer, is going to get them as well. So I'll tell you that I'm getting so much attention from key people in governance that probably would have preferred to go out there and buy these and stock them somewhere in the hospital and then replace them when they break down without the need of training technicians to even fix them. So I think this is a unique opportunity for Africa to wake up to the realities of their own existence and to understand that for all of us to survive, we have to innovate. And the sooner we get at it, the better.
And to what extent, Fred, has the Nana Akufo-Addo administration and other African leaders embraced your timely innovation so far?
That's a good question. You know, I have mixed feelings about it. Mixed feelings in the sense that I've had two key government appointees. That's the Minister for Environment, Science, Technology, and Innovation, a great surgeon who actually performed the first cardio transplant in Ghana. He understands innovation, he appreciates innovation, he encourages innovation, he mentors for innovation. And during the lockdown, he was able to give us an authority note that allowed us to move around the country and to bring vendors to their stores to sell us equipment so that we could build our ventilators. Then we have the Director General of Ghana Standard Authority, who actually came to the workshop to take a look at these ventilators. Now, the moral support has been there, but obviously what we need to move to the next step is the financial wherewithal, and that we have not received any commitments or any thought of commitments from anybody up to this point.
Yes,
I just want to add to, you know, the shining of African excellence that we've seen during this pandemic, from Dr. Tedros, the head of the WHO, to realizations from African leaders, some African leaders, not all, but I'm thinking of South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, who used the opportunity to unroll a 500 billion rand, that's $26 billion stimulus package, but then to say, this pandemic is going to fundamentally restructure our economy and we are going to restructure it on the basis of equality, of opportunity. And these are lovely words. I don't know how they're going to be implemented, but that is a bold statement. And I think it does show that perhaps leaders on this continent are thinking outside of the box in more ways than one, more than just infection control. They're thinking socially, they're thinking economically. And I think we should open our minds to the possibility that in this regard, this continent could teach the world so many lessons that we should be willing to accept and hear.
Anita, unfortunately, when you read reports about what is happening in Africa, a lot of African leaders seem to have embraced the idea of social distancing, but not necessarily being accompanied with what you characterize as an economic sort of stimulus, other than, in fact, you would prefer to say an economic sort of lifeline. Walk us through what you think needs to happen, really, if African countries have to effectively succeed in fighting this particular coronavirus pandemic, because I have heard reports from different African countries, people who are under lockdown, saying that they have actually been now put in a dubious privilege of ending up fighting another, perhaps more potent virus, which they call the starvation virus.
Hey everyone, this is Luol Deng, the ambassador of Basketball Africa League. Now, washing your hands has always been important, but never been as more important as now. What I like to do is turn the tap on, get your hand a little bit wet, turn the tap off. Put the soap in your hand while the tap is off. Start washing your hands. Make sure you get between your fingers, get your wrist, and get the other side of your hand, right? Keep washing your hand. Make sure your hand is as clean as it can be. We want to wash our hand for 20 to 30 seconds, right? Turn your tap back on. So you wash your hands, get in your wrist, and get in your hand. Now, the most important part, when you finish washing your hands, make sure you turn the tap off with your elbow. After you turn the tap off, let your hands dry or use a paper towel. All right? Be safe, everyone.
Hi, everyone. It's Taco Fall. I just wanted to say that now's the time to practice kindness and empathy towards everyone around you. We all doing our best to get through this together, so make sure you do your part. Grab a book, read it to your nieces and nephews on video chat, make a donation of canned goods to your local food bank, or even add some items to your shopping cart for your elderly neighbors. But most importantly, don't forget to just pick up the phone and call somebody and check in. That may mean a lot. You never know. We all can be next to each other right now, but we still can show how much we care about one another. So visit NBATogether.com and join us in inspiring acts of caring. Thank you.
Welcome back to a special edition of Straight Talk Africa. Our topic for today is about African efforts to fight the coronavirus pandemic with scientific and technical and technological tools. Joining us here are my colleague, Anita Powell, Bureau Southern Africa correspondent in Johannesburg, South Africa, and Professor Fred Makabagono-Lili, an engineer and inventor at the Academic City University College in the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Well, Anita and Fred, once again, I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to interact with you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Anita, unfortunately, when you read reports about what is happening in Africa, a lot of African leaders seem to have embraced the idea of social distancing, but not necessarily being accompanied with what you characterize as an economic sort of stimulus. Others, in fact, would prefer to say an economic sort of lifeline. Walk us through what you think needs to happen, really, if African countries have to effectively succeed in fighting this particular coronavirus pandemic, because I have heard reports from different African countries, people who are under lockdown, saying that they have actually been now put in a dubious privilege of ending up fighting another, perhaps more, virus, which they call the starvation virus.
I think you make an excellent point, and I think that a good number of African leaders are looking at this pandemic holistically and weighing the benefits and the drawbacks of imposing lockdowns and restrictions. I'll give you a very good example. In South Africa, 9 million children are beneficiaries of the National School Nutritional Program. This is a program that provides one well-rounded meal every day for every student in about 60% of South African schools that are economically below a certain threshold. For a lot of these children, this is their best meal of the day. And for a lot of these children, tragically, this is their only meal of the day. We know, Dr. Fred can tell you, I'm sure, at length, about the long-term effects of deprivation of micronutrients, about stunting, about how it's not a temporary thing and it's irreversible. So I think a lot of governments are trying to balance this. And some are doing better than others. And some African governments appear to be using the restrictions of this lockdown to either force through laws that are further restricting people's freedoms, to punish journalists, which we're seeing pretty much across the board, to clamp down on free speech, and also to extend their hold on power. Which are obviously that's not cool. It's not a cool way to deal with this pandemic, but we are seeing that as well. I don't want to just say that the continent is handling this beautifully across the board. There are leaders who are doing a lot of stuff behind the scenes that we might not even know about for years to come.
I hear you, Anita, and to be very honest with you, I promise you that one of these days we're going to have to do an edition that is going to be specifically dealing with the issue, the very important issue of civil liberties and what have you that you raised. Let me come to you, Professor. Talk us through what you think needs to be done in order for you to translate the prototypes into a commercial viable industry.
So before I get to that, I'd like to give a shout to the scientists at the Noguchi Memorial Institute in Ghana that were able to sequence the coronavirus also. So that goes to say that when the right atmosphere is created, Africans always rise to the occasion. And this is a major, major achievement that could lead to vaccine development. So I think that the natural steps for product development is the ideation. Then you build the prototypes, and then you build the pre-pilot prototypes, which is what we are doing right now. The next natural step is to go into commercialization, and that requires some investment. And this is usually beyond the salary of a university president. So what I'm looking for are some good investors out there that are listening into this wonderful program, reaching out and saying, look, we can provide some support for this. This could lead to job creation. This could lead to the development of a whole new supply chain. This could help solve some of the unemployment problems that we have. I mean, until we start to make stuff, the unemployment problem will not go away. If we continue to buy commodities into the country, unemployment will never go away. And so I need help, and I'm saying it loud and clear. If somebody can sign a check for $25,000, we'll be able to start developing this low cost And the intent is to even be able to use these devices in places where there is no electricity. We are developing stuff that soldiers can use in the field, villagers can use in their homes, and 50% of this comes from local raw materials that could lead to further employment. And so that's the help we need to cross that chasm from ideation and productization into commercialization.
Is about more than just sitting here and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them
and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure their voices are heard.
Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
How much does each ventilator cost?
So in the commercial marketplace, you can get ventilators as low as $5,000 and all the way up to about $80,000, depending on the whistles and bells you have on it. So they can be really, really expensive for a developing country in particular.
Very interesting. Anita, earlier you talked about how some South African innovators are trying to come up with some kind of testing kits. When are those going to be available on the market so as to help the country and the continent fight the coronavirus pandemic?
Right, so these testing kits that are developed by these two scientists are currently in themselves the testing phase. So they will not be ready for rollout. This is assuming they pass the testing phase until at least June. So that is a ways away.
I see. Now let me come back to you, Professor Fred. You know, it is interesting that you and your colleagues are doing what you are doing, because many people have been wondering why African countries have very expensive, and in some cases prestigious universities, which have schools of science and technology, or faculties of science and technology, and yet, when it comes, for example, to the infrastructure, simply, for example, by making roads, bridges, and what have you, they always have to go to some other countries, so that you do actually have foreigners helping African countries to put the infrastructure in place via foreign aid. Are you perhaps looking at a situation where you are now translating the traditional academic way of training engineers and scientists in Africa into engineers and the scientists in Africa who can actually make a fundamental difference here? Are we talking about a sort of paradigm shift here in terms of education?
Yes. Absolutely. You know, I think one of there are a couple of reasons, actually, why Africa innovation never bubbles to the top. One is that national development imperatives are often not aligned to the expectations from academia. So government policy doesn't translate into things that academics can understand, and academics are not able to translate the things that they do so that policymakers can understand. So there's a chasm. The second reason is that although most of these institutions are heavily financed by government, government really has no expectations what they give back in return. So for most government institutions, the faculty, the staff, the facilities are all paid for by government. So there is actually no reason for people to strive to go out there and get research money, because in other places in the world, research money funds your teaching career pretty much. And so these disjoints are at the forefront of what is causing the problem. The third is that when policy leaders have problems, there's always a certain sense of expediency. Going abroad, getting solutions are faster than dealing locally with professionals. So it's also the proverbial, the prophet is never recognized in his own home. And I say that because when Ghanaians do step out, they become some of the top scientists globally, which means that the ecosystem in which we find ourselves are particularly not supportive. Now, what we are trying to do at Academic City is very different. I mean, I came to academia from industry. The only thing that I knew was to be tasked with challenges that you brought solutions that went to the marketplace and made money. The only time you got to keep your job was to deliver. And so it is the same ethos that we are driving at Academic City College. And we define this ethos around four key pillars. The first being that it has to be contextual. Whatever we are teaching these kids has to be relevant within the African context. It has to be experiential, which means they have to touch, feel, build, and break. It has to be extensional, because it gotta be a kit. We can't teach them everything, but we need to give them the tools to go out there and deliver. And it has to be unified, which means that transdisciplinary education is key. We bring students from across all majors together every year to work on a common project, because that is how the real world operates. And that's a paradigm shift that we are bringing to higher ed in Ghana.
Very interesting. Anita, you also happen to be perhaps in the only country on the African continent that happens to have the distinction of being a genuinely industrialized nation. Is that correct?
Well, during the lockdown, maybe not, but yes. We're in the G20, so yes.
And frankly, it also happens to have some very, very important and functional university institutions. Yeah. To what extent do their education, if, for example, we are talking about the schools of engineering and science, or faculties of engineering and science, to what extent is their education, to what extent does that education allow them not only to talk the talk, but in fact to walk the talk when it comes to what society expects them to do on the ground?
So this is the perfect question for my in-house expert.
My husband,
professor of engineering at the University of Johannesburg, is asking this very question in interminable meetings all this week. But what I do glean from this is universities in South Africa are having a very hard time shifting their education to a remote, to virtual education. And that's because of a lot of gaps in between the haves and the have-nots in South Africa. You can't count on students having access to strong enough internet to attend a class. But yeah, I mean, if you seriously want to talk about this, Shaka, I can bring him in here and he can talk to you about it, because I literally do not know what to tell you.
You guys are doing much better than we are. I mean, if you look at the world university rankings, some of the universities in South Africa, like Cape Town and Witwatersrand, I think, if I said it right, are some of the top universities in the world. And in my experience in South Africa, which is very little, there's a very strong industry-academia interface. Now, it may not be across all the universities, but definitely the top research universities in South Africa are homes of innovation, they are homes of spin-offs, and they have a very, very excellent academic industry type interactions. So you guys are doing way much better than we ought to do.
I think that's because you don't know the backstory.
Fred, if you, for example, if for some reason, the important African players, both in terms of those who actually head their nation states and those who head the African Union and regional cooperation like ECOWAS, East African Community, and SADC, if they were watching this program, could you please look in your nearest microphone and tell them what you think you need in order to make them proud with your invention, so that they could be in a situation where they don't really see far away from someone from their member countries who can actually make a difference in terms of fighting the coronavirus pandemic on the continent.
I would like to say that Africa is a continent of innovators, and it is time for us to start looking internally also for some of the intractable solutions to our problems. You know, when you look at a typical ventilator from the outside with all the whistles and bells on it, all the beeping sounds, all the colors, all the lights, it looks impossible. It looks frightening. It looks like something that has to come in from abroad. But the fundamental technology in it is very, very simple. And expediency is not going to move the needle for us. We need to start realigning our educational institutions around the challenges, local challenges that we need to resolve. I think our continued discussion of economic policies without the underlying industrialization that it takes will never move the needle for us. I think we need inter-regional collaborations among our universities. I will be happy to work with students from Cameroon. I'll be happy. I have students from 18 African countries in my university. And I think that is the trend that we need to follow. So I'm appealing to them to step up, throw a little bit of support in our direction, help us bring this product to the marketplace at a cost that is affordable to the average clinic and the average hospital around the world and around the continent. So I'm appealing to them to make resources available. ECOWAS is capable of doing it. East Africa Economic Community is capable of doing it. Let's find local solutions to our problems, because even when we bring technologies from abroad, we have to customize them to our situation. And we should tap into our local talents. We spend millions and millions of dollars on our universities every year. It is time for us to give them the opportunity to shine.
On that note, our distinguished guests were my colleague Anita Powell
and Professor Fred Makabagwan-Rudi.
Thank you very much, Anita and Fred.
In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please, please remember to keep the African hope alive.